Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to the latest United We Stand podcast. My name's Andy Mittem, and I'm in a restaurant in central Manchester with today's guest, who is Danny Webber. Danny is a Manchester lad. He's from Longside, which is where Danny Welbeck is also from. And he played for Manchester United. He joined United as a 13-year-old. He rose through the youth ranks. He played for the first team, not in a Premier League game, but in several cup matches in 1999, 2000, 2001. He's had a good career in football, playing for teams like Watford, Port Vale, Sheffield United, Leeds United, Doncaster Rovers, and he's now at Accrington Stanley. He's 31 years old. Welcome, Danny. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
You're right, Andy.
So you're at Accrington now, the 92nd club. Slightly different from where your career started out.
Yes, opposite end of the spectrum. massively different in many ways, but I suppose many people would say that's real football.
You enjoying it?
Yeah, yeah, I enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's like going back to, you know, going back to your roots, in effect, where, you know, you have to, in effect, put the nets up and that kind of thing. You know, it's proper football, proper lads, you know, proper arguments, proper, real football. I feel like I should be paying my subs every week.
So you grew up in Longside?
All over South Manchester, yeah. You know, when I was born, lived in Levenshulme, you know, we've been in Burnage, been in Didsbury, been all over South Manchester, to be fair. I travelled a lot when I was a kid.
What did your parents do?
My dad did, he used to work at the airport, working for like the catering people who put the food on the planes and stuff like that. Then he went on to, drove lorries for most of me sort of teenage years, to be fair. he used to be rushing back from wherever he'd been just to get me to the cliff to do training. Or Manchester Boys, or whoever it was. And then when I got to like 16, the Trafford Centre opened, and he ended up working on the men's suits bit in the Trafford Centre. Total change of career. But my mum's always worked in travel. That's her passion. She's always, what you know, always getting someone the best flight, the best deal, the best whatever it may be. And you know, she's moved around the country as well, you know, with my mum as well, but always basically her passion has been travel. And probably for the last 14 years she's worked at Withinshaw Hospital, Withington, but then Withinshaw Hospital. She's still at Withinshaw Hospital now.
Who did you support as a kid?
United. It's a no-brainer, you know. from day one, really. My dad took us to watch United. It was, my dad's passionate about it. Most of my family weren't sort of football orientated. Got a massive family, but my dad's always been, you know, he used to go on the terraces back in the day and tell me about his days on the terraces, his sort of being next to the hooligan kind of thing, being the one person who weren't a hooligan. However much of that I believe, I don't know, but do you know what I mean? Yeah, always United.
So you were signed by United at 13 years old?
10. Yeah.
How did that come about?
Playing Manchester Boys. And I was at City at the time, and I remember we used to go down to Platt Lane, and something within my spirit just didn't enjoy it. You know, I'd be there every week, and I remember thinking, you're doing press-ups and this and that. I'm thinking, what am I doing press-ups for? You know, I just wanted to play football. That was it. We used to go down to Platt Lane, and the guy at the time used to give me the forms, you know, take that home to your dad and sign it. So I'd come home from Platt Lane, and I'd probably just throw it on the side and not really care too much about it. And then next week I'd come in and go, have you signed the forms yet? I'd be like, no, I've not signed them yet. I've lost my form, so they give me a new form every week. And then I remember Nobby used to stand at the side of the pitch.
Nobby Styles.
Nobby stood at the side of the pitch, Manchester Boys. And my dad used to be like, oh, that's Nobby Styles. And I just remember Nobby pulling my dad, and one of the other scouts, Brian Poole, who actually brought me in, after he'd been down to watch me a few times, obviously Nobby used to come and like sort of cast his eye over whoever Poole he was talking about, and Nobby sort of came and said, look, we'd like to come down to the cliff. So you know, from then on, it was a no-brainer,
So you go onto the cliff twice a week?
Yeah, Tuesdays, Thursdays. First day I walked in, it was Nobby, Brian Kidd, Pop Robson. Just felt like a total contrast to City. City was like, oh, hard work, and, you know, when I say hard work, I mean hard, because you don't enjoy it.
United was about the football?
United was just about, you know what, the cliff, yeah, it might be leaking the roof, but let's just pass the ball, let's you know, do things that were fun, and flair, you know, these stewards used to emphasise your flair.
And Nobby and Kiddo were very hands-on.
Yeah, and Pop as well, all of them, they were brilliant. I don't know, you just get a sense of people know what they're talking about, even from a young age. Someone says something and makes sense, it just sits in you the right way, and everything they said made sense. You know, you're just walking around the cliff, you know, you see the odd first teamer once in a while, the boss would turn up as well sometimes, so it was daunting, but just felt like home from the moment I stepped through the door.
You continued to progress, you scored a lot of goals in the young United side,
mm-hmm.
and then when you were 16 you were offered an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So was that always something you wanted to do when you were 12, 13, 14, when you think, I want to be a football player?
Yeah.
And I'm good enough to. You're like the best in your school.
I think you know it as a kid, don't you? You know, when you're cocky enough to be like, not to say it to other people, but you're cocky enough with the way you carry yourself. You're cocky enough to know that you are the best. You know, you don't score 7 goals in a game and not be the best, and you don't, you know, you come off the pitch scoring 7, 5, 9 or whatever it is at different levels. You know you are the best at that time without being sort of, you know, you're just teenage and you're having yourself a little bit, you know.
So your apprenticeship straight from school?
I went to Lillishaw first. I left at 14. I went to Lillishaw. Spent 2 years there. You know, my year was the likes of Joe Cole. Joe Cole's probably obviously the one who's done the best out of our year. You know, Leon Mike, who's one of my good friends now, he was at City at the time, so we used to, you know, we're still best friends now, me, him, and a friend, a guy called Gavin.
Was Leon related to AD, Mike?
Yeah, cousins, yeah. A lot of people still sort of, even now, they still call him AD. Do you know what I mean?
I used to play against AD.
Did you, yeah?
He played for Flixton Juniors.
Yeah.
He was the best. There were 3 good players in our league.
Yeah.
He was one of the 3.
Yeah.
Simon Davis, mm-hmm. was one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
AD Mike, and there was another kid called Ryan Wilson.
Okay.
But I don't know what happened to
him. Not Giggsy, no.
So he was obviously at Dean's, but yeah, AD was he was good, and I think he played for City's first team, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
So you were at Lillishaw?
Yeah.
You continued your education at Lillishaw?
Yeah. I think had I not been to Lillishaw, I wouldn't have, my grades wouldn't have been as good. I wouldn't have, you know, because I wouldn't have been as sort of, had to be studious there, you know.
And what grades did you get?
I did all right for, you know, C's and above's on everything.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Well, C's on everything, apart from, I got an A in cooking. I had to hold that one back.
So, yeah, well above the national average, basically.
Yeah, I did all right. And you know, when you know you're bright enough, you absorb things, you take, you know you can take things on board. But had I been back home, there's more distraction. You know, we had to study every night at Lillishaw. So, you sort of, it's nothing else to do. You have to do your studying. You know, you're in a set regimen, set regime, and you have to do it. So I think it benefited me from that point of view.
So you spent a couple of years at Lillishaw?
2 years, from being 14 to 16.
And then you came back to Manchester?
Yeah.
And you signed for United?
Signed a sort of a YT until I was 17. And then it was sort of set in when my 17th birthday kicked in, you get a pro. So I had a 3-year pro from that moment. Just cracked on, really. I think it was a continuation of being at Lillishaw. We trained every day, so we just went straight into YT. So I sort of hit the ground running at 16.
As a striker?
Yeah, as a striker, yeah.
And you playing in United reserve teams then?
Yeah,
alongside which players?
It was 17s and 19s, so we were playing at the time, you know, years above me were like your Healy's and your Notmans, and they were the people I was trying to sort of, you know, break past and that kind of thing. John Green in the Resi team. Still good friends with Bojan Djordjic as well.
I know Bojan.
Yeah, me and Bo were like probably, you know, very good friends. He stayed at mine last year. We're good mates.
Bojan was a guest on this podcast recently.
Was he? Yeah.
I didn't know you knew him, but I know Bojan well.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a call off Bojan last year. And I'd gone on Twitter and said, I'm in Holland at a match. He went, come and watch me play tonight.
Yeah.
Well, where am I going to stay? Stay at mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Except Bojan didn't have an apartment. He had an hotel room.
Yeah.
And Bojan, people are going to get the wrong idea here. He took me out round Antwerp.
Yeah.
He'd been there for a week. He knew every Serb gangster in the city.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, when I went to Sweden, went over to Sweden, and it was similar. We went out. I've never walked into a club 25 men strong and just, you know, the doorman turned a blind eye and all that kind of thing. He looked after me as well, to be fair, in Sweden.
We went to Sweden last month. Mm. Bojan came to meet me at my hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I mean, I'm happily married, but I thought Bojan is a single, good-looking, famous lad in Sweden because he does all his TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I imagined a night being surrounded by absolute beauties.
Mm-hmm.
Bojan said to me, I want a drink with the hardcore.
Yeah.
An hour later, we were in an Irish bar in Stockholm as he spoke to a load of growlers from Manchester who absolutely loved him
and
now keep coming up to me going, that Bojan's ace, isn't
he? He is top draw. When he first came here, he'll probably tell you this himself, me and Jimmy, like, used to be, you know, banter people and that kind of thing. So when Bojan first came in, it's almost like, who's this kid coming in with his, you know, with his quiff, and, you know, came in and he was a little bit
It was cocky. It wasn't at first.
And we used to do little stuff in the cliff, like, you know, in the afternoons you'd be doing your practicing your techniques. Bojan couldn't use his right foot, so he'd always be put with me and Jim. We'd always be like, Bo, can't you kick it? And he'd roll in our eyes every time he shanked it and this and that and the other. But it's only because when we went to Carrington, I used to pick him up every morning and he used to get in my car and he'd go, let's put on Biggie or put on whatever, and we'd end up having the best, you know, we've got a great friendship because of that. But at first he was quite shy.
You mentioned Jimmy, that's Jimmy Davis, who played up front with him for United's youth team.
Yeah.
Jimmy, most people listening to this will know, he passed away 10 years ago in a tragic car accident on the M40. You must have some great memories of playing with Jimmy up front with him.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. From being kids, you know, I think back to things like the Milk Cup and, you know, all the games through the youth level. We just used to have fun. We went out there and you just knew that with Jimmy beside me, you had the same work ethic, you had the same mentality, you know, the same sort of, at the time, the same kind of killer instincts that you needed to have to score goals and, you know. And we just had fun. We'd go out there and on and off the pitch just have a laugh.
He was from Redditch.
From Redditch,
so he moved up to Manchester. Yeah. I assume he stayed in Diggs.
He was in Philomena's, Diggs in Salford, yeah. He was in Philomena's. And considering he was the closest to the training ground, he was late every day. Until the older lads gave him an ice bath, which at the time was a punishment. Now everyone does it every week. But it was a punishment. He got him naked in the ice bath and threw ice all over him and that because he was late. But he learnt his lesson and managed to just sneak in before 9:15.
So you're scoring goals in United reserves,
mm-hmm.
you get offered a professional contract, you're a young lad from Manchester, playing for Manchester United. Did you think you could get into the first team?
100%. I mean, that was always your mentality. I mean, the way I sort of approach things, if you don't think you can do it, don't bother doing it at all. You know, and a lot of people say, why don't you go to Crewe, or why don't you go to a team lower down and then get in the first team and then establish yourself? And I always think you've got to aim for the top. And if you fall just short within your life, which inevitably in certain circumstances you will, if you fall just short, then you'll always do all right. But if you aim, you know, if you aim mediocre and then you fall short, or then something happens where it doesn't go right, go your way, then there's not, you know, you fall very far from where you want to be.
You training with the first team?
Sometimes, yeah. It was Rezzy's first team. You know, I remember training with the first team even at 16 at the Cliff. And the bus had, you know, because what happened with the first team, we train at the Cliff. And the, you know, the Reds and the YTs would go all the way around to Littleton Road. So if you were, you know, if you were ever off the bus and you had to, you were called back kind of thing, remember your heart would be beating in the box and stuff. You're looking at, you know, Coley and Yorkie and Giggs and Scholes and Bex. And, you know, it's unreal when you actually look back at the careers those guys have had. It's unreal. And you see the standard they were hitting then. You know, it's that's sort of where I measure my standards from now, as being when people mention, oh, he's a good player, I still think back to that and I think, well, actually he doesn't lace such and such a Bex or Scholes his boots.
What would they do? I know what Maddie went from Barca's reserves to the first team, and the one thing he said was the speed in which they ping the ball around,
mm-hmm.
frightened him.
Yeah.
That was it. The one standout was the speed, the thought process.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
that's it. That's the one thing I'd say would separate the top from the bottom, because you've got people who've got good ability in lower leagues even and that kind of thing. They don't see the game. They don't see things. And two, they can't. And if you do see it, you can't do it quickly. And to see it and do it continuously, you know, Scholes's been unbelievable at it for the last 20 years.
Who was good with you of the first team players?
I think Coley was good. I used to clean Coley's boots. And
I told him I was speaking to you for this.
Yeah.
Said, good boy.
Yeah.
So if he says you're a good boy, you must be good. Because you know what Coley's like.
Yeah, exactly.
You're one of about three people in the world he likes.
Nah, his quality. Coley was always good. I think certain people along the way, you think, just get you. And Coley got me from me walking in and cleaning my boots. And I think he understood that when you've not got a lot of money as a YT or that kind of thing, and you've saved up for a pair of trainers or whatever. I remember walking into the first team dressing room when I had a pair of trainers that I'd saved up and waited at Foot Locker for ages. And I felt buzzing that he'd gone, oh, Webb's one of them trainers. You know what I mean? I was buzzing with that thing. So Coley was all, you could always relate to Coley.
Did he give you a Christmas tip?
He just used to give me boots and that all the time, to be fair. He was good like that. He'd always just, you know, take a pair of boots or take whatever I needed, or a trackie or something, which was better than a tip, because you know, when you're not earning a lot of money, that was like gold. And especially it makes you, when you got the rest of the YTs looking at you as well, like, what, Coley's give you that or whatever, you know, you've got a little wry smile on your face, haven't you?
Which other lads stood out? Any interesting stories of the first team players?
I remember Peter Schmeichel. This comes to me head a lot. When I chipped a penalty on him when I was 16, cocky, and he dived and he went down the middle and he chased me all the way around the cliff. And then from that day on, we used to have to stand and get the first team to sign stuff with a permanent marker. He'd grab the permanent marker every morning and draw on my face. Every morning this went on for weeks on end. And I just thought, then you sort of get your hierarchy, don't you? Like, get back in your place, lad. And so that always stands out to me. And I remember some of the young lads were... at the time, Ashley Dodd and Josh Walker. Josh Walker actually works for Spotify now, and they had to shave their testicles because they'd had, you know, in front of everybody, they had to do it in the treatment room. I just remember the lad roaring, you know, some of the stuff was unbelievable.
Just getting them to do,
yeah, because they stepped out of line a little bit. Do you know what I mean? I think that's what's missing in the game at the moment.
That was in front of the first team.
Yeah, in the treatment room, so anyone who was there saw it. Do you know what I mean? And I just think that's what's missing in football, a bit of banter. Now it's kind of seen as bullying, you know, but it just keeps your feet on the ground and keeps the hierarchy, you know. You have to earn your stripes, and I just don't see that as much as I used to, and I think that's missing.
I interviewed loads of the lads from the 70s, 80s and 90s, and some of the stories they tell me, which would definitely be seen as bullying now. Yeah. They've got one lad at the cliff and they put him in a ball bag.
Yeah.
And then the four of them carried him into the road. Yeah. And just left him in the middle of the road.
Exactly. I mean, when I was at Sheffield United, one of the lads had gone out and had a drink. So what he did, we'd stayed in a hotel, and they wheeled his bed out, literally picked his mattress up, took him out onto the golf course and left him in the bunker. And he woke up in the morning with his covers over him in the bunker, and people were playing golf. And just stuff like that. Now, I mean, it's just, you know, it goes, it's gone missing a little bit.
Any other stuff like that? I love hearing stories of just stupid pranks.
Thing
involving getting coach drivers, you know, to take the clothes off for 30 quid.
He always used to, one of my first days at Sheffield United as well, he had one of the lads had his trainers or his shoes glued to the floor, horrendous shoes. So he's trying to get his shoes, and the soles are still there now. And if you go to the training ground, the soles of his shoes are actually still glued to the floor. So he had to go home and put in his training boots and that. But yeah,
on Ray Wilkins' first day at the cliff, Lou McCara decided it was a bit flash, a bit cockney.
Yeah.
So he nailed his boot, his new cockney shoes to the floor, and Ray's like trying to put them on, and they wouldn't move because they were nailed to the floor. Juvenile humour, but that's like the oil of a dressing room, isn't it? That's what makes people
definitely. Now a lot of people take offence to stuff like that, you know, and just let it roll off your back and be easy about it. You know, we'd always, I remember another lad when I was at Sheffield United, he was like a prankster, you know, you'd enjoy talking to him, to be fair. He's had first night in your hotel. So what he used to do, he'd get your hotel key and he'd unscrew, you know, the little spy hole. He'd unscrew it, and then he'd knock your door from the outside, and then he'd blow in your eye. You know what I mean? Your eye would start watering, and you'd open the door. Once you'd open the door, he left a bucket of water on the door, leaned on the door. So you'd be stood there with an eye that's watering and two soaking feet, and he'd just be running down the corridor laughing at you. But just, yeah, just mad stuff like that. Just, you know, gone missing a little bit.
I can't get an image out of my head of a man waking up in a bed on a golf course.
Brilliant, mate. Absolutely brilliant.
You went on loan to several clubs while you were at United to get more experience.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Port Vale.
Yeah.
You went to Watford.
Yeah.
You went to Watford again.
Mm-hmm.
And then you signed full-time for Watford.
Yeah.
Was that a realisation that you weren't going to make it at United? Did you have a conversation with Sir Alex Ferguson? Mm-hmm. Did you go and see him, or did he call you in one day?
More of, well, first off, Port Vale. I just made my debut against Sunderland, and I remember Gaffer's came into me one Friday morning and just said, "Son, you're going on loan." I was like, "Oh, okay, where am I going?" He said, "You're going to Port Vale for a month." "Oh, okay, fair enough." So I've gone to Port Vale. First day, we're running up and down the stands, which I'm thinking, where's the football? I didn't see a football. Running up and down the stands. Then we had we played in a gym, wooden floor, benches a goal, you know, the furry yellow ball. I'm thinking, Jesus, this is a little bit different. But again, you're just mucking. You're not come from a lot, so you crack on with whatever you're given. Do you know what I mean? And then I made my debut. I was horrendous. I remember thinking, Jesus, like, I probably spent most of the probably 60 minutes I played so asking people to give it to me feet. You know, like, give it to me feet and just run, mate. Just, you know, it's almost like, okay, you've just got to run.
Clash of culture completely.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason you go there. It's a reality check of what you actually have and, you know, kind of thing. And then,
is it an idea for clubs to have a second team which is allowed to play in the fourth, third, second division, like Spain, for example?
I think it's a good idea.
Because you've been taught to play football one way and suddenly you've been sent to somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like playing a different game.
Definitely. I mean, that's what I found throughout my career. In all honesty, I mean, everybody can sit and say football's the same, and you know, but it isn't. You're coming up against a clash of styles, a clash of personalities, a clash of opinions, and a lot of, you know, sometimes people go, "Oh, you're not at United anymore." But I've always come from this sort of opinion of, yeah, fair enough, you're not at United anymore, but that's the standard you've got to reach. The same, you know, every team that does well passes the ball. You retain possession of the football. That's what I've been taught from 10 to 21 at United. So, you know, that was, I struggled with that in my first year when I left, to be honest, because I used to say things like, "Give me the ball on my safe side," which doesn't mean, if you've got a man on you, it doesn't mean you can't receive the ball. But, you know, people go, "You've got a man on you." I say, "Give it me on the safe side. It doesn't matter. I'll still take the ball." And I had a lot of sort of things to get my head around when I first left. But Port Vale was one of them where, after the month-long spell, I remember playing away at Boothbury Park, Hull, in the LDV Vans Trophy. And I got kicked for 45 minutes by the right-back. I played left wing that game. I actually remember stood for the first time on a pitch thinking, "What am I doing? Like, what am I doing here?" Anyway, again, you know the bigger picture is you're at United and you're trying to go, so you crack on with it and try and make the best out of it. We got to the end of the loan spell and Brian Horton was the manager at the time. He'd rang the boss and said, "Can I keep Weber on loan for another couple of months?" So the gaffer said, "Yeah." So Brian Horton came to me after the game and said, "I've spoken to Sir Alex and he said we can stay for another couple of months. Is that all right, son?" And nothing within me could say yes. I actually said, "No, actually, I'm going to go back to United." Even though the boss had said, "You can have it." So I'm thinking, geez, what kind of reception am I going to get? I hadn't spoken to, you know, by the gaffer when I got back to Carrington. So I remember being back in Carrington the next day. Obviously, me eating my breakfast, gaffer walks in the door, heart starts beating, and he says, "Oh, I thought you were staying on at Port Vale." He said, "Brian rang me last night and said you didn't want to stay. Why not, son?" I'm thinking, what do I say? Do I say what I don't feel? And I just said, the only thing that came to my head, I went, "To be honest, Gaffer, I think I can play at a higher level than that." And he went silent for a second, I thought. He went, "Ah, you're right, son. You know, he said, "Good lad," and just walked and sort of walked off. And I thought, okay. That wasn't the reaction I expected, but, you know, it's... I think he valued the fact that I valued myself to be able to play better standard of football and was strong enough at 18, 19 to be able to say it to a manager. So, you know, after that, I ended up going to Watford, and he just said to me, look, Viali's the manager. He said, I want you to go and learn off Viali. He's going to play you up front. He said, which is your best position? He said, I want you to go and learn from him for a month, 6 weeks, the end of the season. And I think with the gaffer having said that and then going to work under Viali, they obviously had their understanding of what they wanted me to do. My game came on so much within that six weeks, more than it had done in a, you know, playing games, as well as being able to implement what I was doing on the training ground. Came on so much, so that was probably my most beneficial loan spell, just that 6 weeks.
Playing under Viali.
Playing under Viali.
He's a posh Italian, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's from like a really posh family.
Yeah, yeah, he's from a wealthy Italian family, but I don't think the hard work thing went amiss with him. He was very meticulous about what he did. And I remember one of the lads, he'd named the team on the Friday and we'd gone away, we were playing away, Stockport. And Stockport obviously were in Championship at the time.
No club has fallen as far as Stockport County in
Never.
English football.
It's frightening.
We're, apart from the ones who've gone bust and restarted again,
yeah.
Stockport County are now at the bottom of a league where clubs have got an average crowd of 240.
Jesus. Yeah. That's, and what
crowd
are they?
They've gone down and down. They're down to about 3,000, Stockport, okay. So they've got a really good hardcore. I feel sorry for them.
Yeah.
They've just gone down and down and down. It's been an absolute mess.
Yeah.
So you've done well with Watford. They offered you a full-time contract.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant leaving Manchester for the first time in your life?
Well, I had done after a couple of loan spells, yeah. The gaffer had offered me 3 years to stay at United. He'd offered me in and around the March, April. February, March, April time. And then I think I'd always sat down with my dad when I was younger, and we'd always said, if you get to 21 and you're not consistently playing in the first team, you need to forge a career for yourself. And that was the hardest decision I've ever had to make in football, actually, saying no to a contract and going.
And was it a good contract?
Yeah, it was decent.
It was proper money rather than.
Yeah, no. Because I'd already signed a couple of contracts in between then anyway. So it was a good upgrade. But it was a case of do you stay? Because me and Jimmy both got offered at the same time. Jimmy decided to take the 3 years. I decided not to take the 3 years. Jimmy came on loan anyway. So that's how we ended up both at Watford. But I decided at the time, I thought, you know what, I need to go and play football. I'd had a taste of it. I wanted to play. I spoke to the coaches, and obviously Bellion came in at the time and people like that. And I just thought, I'd been fighting against, I remember being 16, fitting against Wheatcroft, Fitzpatrick, Healy, Notman, Greening. Obviously, then you've got Forlan, York, Cole, Solskjaer, Sheringham. And then everybody who came in, if I've missed anyone in between that. And I'm thinking, right, I've tasted it a little bit. I need to play. And I always had in my mind the thought that you leave on good terms, you never know, if you go away and do well for a couple of years, then, it might buy you back.
You did play in the first team.
I did, yeah. I played played three games, twice in the Worthington Cup, or Carling Cup as it is now, and once in the Champions League. So,
what do you remember about your debut?
I remember my first touch was a clearance from the corner.
Was this 2001?
I think it was 2001, November 2000, I think.
Against Arsenal?
No, against Sunderland away. And I remember my first touch cleared a corner. We went up the other end and got a free kick, and Quinton Fortune whipped the free kick in, and I headed it, and my first attempt, headed it, keeper saved it onto the bar, and it went over. And I just remember thinking, wow, just like, Jesus, this is unbelievable. But I must have got about 20 minutes or something. It felt like about a minute of my adrenaline was pumping that much. But then we got beat and got knocked out of the cup.
You did play against Arsenal in the League Cup?
Yeah, I did. That was the following year. Me and Jimmy played up front together. He forgot his boots.
And it was Jimmy's debut?
Yeah, Jimmy's actually.
He forgot his boots on his debut.
His boots, yeah. That was a little bit, that was his character. Very just at ease and blasé with life, and he thought I'd hidden him. He's gone, Webb, seriously, where's my boots? And Bojan played in that as well. And he's gone, Webb, Bo, seriously, where's my boots? Said, Jim, we ain't got your boots. When did you last see them? In the hotel room. Yeah, but I've not got your boots. So I had to lend him my spare pairs, and he played in them boots. And he went checking on the coach and everything at Highbury. It was a good night, despite us getting absolutely battered. I spoke to, when I played at Portsmouth, I spoke to Canu about it, because Canu played with Wiltord in that game. And he remembered the game, and he was on fire that day. I think Wiltord got a hat-trick, but Canu was just, he was unbelievable at 40 when he could barely move, never mind then.
That's if he was 40.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Better not speculate anymore on that. And you used to buy United We Stand when you were younger,
yeah,
at the ground?
Yeah, we used to go. My dad would always park at White City, go to the game. Park at White City, buy United We Stand, and read it before the game and at half time and whatever. And I'll get the chips on the way home, standard chip it. And we'd always buy it every week.
So. You're playing at Watford, you're mm-hmm. playing with Jimmy?
Yeah.
In the same team?
Yeah.
First team, doing well?
Yeah. Well, first team, he only managed to do pre-season. It was the night before he passed was... the night he passed was the day before the start of the season. So we'd done pre-season, the lads loved him. He'd sang Gangster's Paradise in front of the lads. And, he was practicing his words and everything in the room. And then when we were in Finland... And he went out, did a performance. He got a standing ovation off the Watford lads. You know, he had that much character, the way he did it and the way he delivered it. You know, lads buzzed off him. And sadly, obviously that happened. So that year, obviously, we never got to play a competitive game in the first team together. There,
so that was a decade ago. Mm-hmm. It was headline news when he passed away.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
His car crashed on the M40. How did mm-hmm. you find out?
I found out before his family knew. It happened. This was on the Friday night. Obviously, I'm preparing for the game. He'd been injured, so he just had a little ankle sprain or something, so he wasn't going to play the following day. So I went to his hotel. I'd just gotten myself an apartment. So I went to his house, and he got his. But I had dinner with him the Friday night. So 9:30, we sat in the hotel having dinner, and I said, "Look, Jim, I'm going to go home." And he went, "Oh, I might go back to Birmingham." So I said to him, "I said, Jim, there's no point. You may as well just." Just stay here. You're in treatment in the morning at 9:00. Yeah, you know, he missed his family. He's very, very close with his family So we just sort of thought, as far as I was aware, I'd left him and he'd gone to bed. So he'd obviously decided to drive back to Birmingham to see his family. And I found out the following morning. I got a phone call from Terry Byrne, who actually became Bex's manager.
I spoke to him last year. He was in New York at New York Cosmos.
That's right. Yeah. So he was general manager at Watford at the time, and Ray Lewington was manager, and he was general manager. So I remember saying, I got a phone call. I thought, why is he ringing me at half eight in the morning? He went, "Webbs, you need to come down to the stadium. Something with your paperwork that needs sorting out." He obviously didn't want to tell me over the phone. So I pulled into the car park, and I remember thinking, two police cars, Ray Lew's car and Terry Byrne's car. My initial thought was, what have I done? I'm thinking, I've literally got a minute as I'm walking in thinking, what have I done? Have I done anything to somebody? Have I cut somebody up and they've had an accident? What have I done? You know, and then I walked in and I saw tears in Ray Lewinson's eyes. And Terry was sort of choked. And he said, "Webb's, just, you know, the officers in there need to speak to you. You've not done anything you need." So spoke to the two officers. And they just said, you know, basically, you know, black BMW was found, you know, on the M40. You know, they couldn't identify the driver and that kind of thing. The only reason they sort of knew it was his car was because his number plate had rolled up the bank and they found his number plate. And they said, you know, "I'm sorry to sort of have to tell you, you know, but is there any possibility that anybody else could have been driving his car?" I said, "Nah," I said, "no way," because Jim wouldn't even let someone drive it around the car park. He was like that, you know, he got a new car and he worked hard for it and it was his pride and joy kind of thing. So, he wouldn't let anybody drive it around the car park. So I just, you know, when you got the feeling, so immediately pulled my phone out, tried to ring him and ring him in a room, so I tried to ring about 20 or 30 times. Obviously went to voicemail. They'd already been to the hotel, seen the CCTV coverage, seen that I'd been with him on that night, and, you know, so that's why they came to me first and checked his room, and then obviously he'd gone home. He obviously eventually had to send police officers around to tell his family. It was a horrible time, because you just don't actually process it. You don't process it and see it with any clarity. And I think for that season, looking back at it, I obviously hadn't dealt with it as well as I thought I was dealing with it in the moment. Because everyone would say, "Are you all right?" And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. But there was days when I'd finish training, sit by the computer. I didn't want to go home because I just wanted to be on the pitch. And, you know, so I'd sometimes be training so much that the lads would be going home in the cars and I'd still be out training on the pitch. And then when I would get home, I was living down there by myself. So sometimes I'd sit in front of the computer and it'd be 10 o'clock before I'd even eaten or anything, and I don't even know how it got to be 10 o'clock. So you obviously, you're not in the right place if them kind of things are happening to you. You know, your thoughts are massively elsewhere. But yeah, you know, I wore a vest with his name on it, and every time I scored, it was like the biggest relief of passions, you know, to sort of get it out there kind of thing. So yeah, at the end of that season, I also played with a metal plate in my leg because I'd broken my leg in my last game at United for United in the reses. So I think it was as a 21-year-old, you know, first time you'd sort of properly as an adult been away from home. There's a lot to have happened to process in such a short space of time, and to appear to the world as if you're on top of the world. So
and is there a pressure to appear to the world like you're on top of the world when you're speaking to journalists, when you're speaking fans? Have you got to put this face of normality on, even when it's not the truth?
I think you do. Yeah, I think you're in an environment.
You don't show weakness.
Yeah, you don't show weakness, and I think you only as you become more comfortable with yourself as an adult, you can actually say how you actually felt. Other than that, you're always, everybody say you're all right. You go, yeah, I'm all right, and you may be all right, but you're not actually, what's going on in your head is totally different. And you know, there's many opportunities where I felt, at the time there was a guy at Watford who was like a psychologist, and I remember him saying, look, you know, come and speak to me if you want to speak to me. I was like, no, I'm fine. And then he called me and he said, look, I'm just having dinner at the hotel, blah blah, you know, if you want to. So he said, oh, come and have a chat. So I had a chat with him a few times, but then it annoyed me because my form was bad as well. I wasn't playing well. It annoyed me that what's meant to be confidential wasn't confidential, and he ended up going into telling the gaffer everything that, you know, that I was thinking. And I noticed it after seeing him twice, and he tried to ring me and I didn't answer my phone again after that. I just thought, I'm not, you know, you've lost my trust, not interested.
A huge breach of trust. I spoke to one player who confided in the club doctor, and it got back to the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Another who was going through a divorce, and the assistant manager said, you know, I've been through a divorce myself, and he confided in the assistant manager.
Mm-hmm.
Got back to the manager, who read that as, your head's not in the right place. Yeah. You're not going to start this week, and that just smashed his confidence.
Definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can understand. I mean, no matter how it's viewed or how fans view it. I mean, I'm a football fan myself, so I understand when you're looking at the TV and things don't go the way you want them to, or the way you expect them to, or, you know, somebody makes a bad pass or somebody misses a chance. You know, I can see it from in front of and behind the lens. I can see it both ways.
There's usually a backstory why somebody's not playing well.
Yeah.
There are factors which people
always
don't see.
Always, but I mean,
And there might be private factors which people, mm-hmm, you know, it's no one else's business.
Yeah, well, you know, every fan wouldn't, you know, sort of lay bare what's going on in their life. So I think, yes, it is part of the territory, but there needs to remain a certain amount of privacy that you're allowed to, you know, where you're allowed to keep your dignity, you're allowed to keep whatever it is that's going on in your private life private, you know. And I think that's why the likes of David Beckham and people like that have had to close ranks at certain times within their life. You have to do that because there are certain things that are not, you know, not to be aired in public.
United sent a whole delegation down to Jimmy's funeral.
Yeah.
Full first team went down.
Full first
team. To Redditch.
Yeah. Full first team, full Watford team, full Swindon team, everywhere he'd represented. It was a great turnout. You know, it's. And obviously, they did the tribute at the cup final as well. They had his shirt on underneath. And just testament to the impression he left on people, I think.
You had any contact with his parents since?
Yeah, I spoke to his mum a couple of weeks ago. And she's, you know, she just. I did, you know, we spoke about it, obviously being the anniversary and everything, and she's okay, and he's, you know, his family's okay. You know, he doted on his parents and his granddad, his sister, his brother. And yeah, they're all okay, they're all getting on. It's obviously painful, but they've, you know, they've come to terms with what's happened over the years, and, you know, he still plays a part in their life in whatever way he can, in his memory.
You found yourself being a championship-level striker.
Mm-hmm.
You played at Sheffield United.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you'd hit a point when you were at Watford and at Sheffield United where you're playing most weeks, you're having your ups and your downs, mm-hmm, it's a normal footballer life. You're getting paid good money,
mm-hmm,
you're famous on a localised level. Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy it once you'd established yourself as a footballer?
I enjoyed it, but always, I mean, even to today, you know, you always think to yourself, sit and you think, did you do yourself justice when you played in the Premier League? Because that's ultimately where you wanted to play, you know. Ultimately wanted to play for United, but next step was the Premier League, next step was the Championship. And you think, I played, you know, 40, 50 games in the Premier League, bearing in mind most of them were out wide. However, it does, you know, that's is what it is.
There are not many Englishmen who play 40 or 50 games in the Premier League. You're talking about percentages. Mm. You're in the top 0.5% of footballers. You've not been a Giggsy. Right?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he's Welsh anyway.
Yeah. No. When you think about it, I mean, Dad said something to me. He said, "You know what, son? Because I've always had that same target I set when I was sort of 10 to 16 to 21. You always see United as being success or actual, you know, doing well. When my dad said to me, you know, you've done well despite the fact of that was your level. I mean, when I made reference to sort of just falling below, and I think my career I've just fallen below, but I've not had a bad career. If you look, I've had, you know, what I've had to contend with, I've had 14 operations in so many years. People don't know that, but you know, I've had 14 operations. People know about some.
Where?
Knees. Two knees, two shoulders, broken leg. That's the basis of what I've had. You know, some of them were going into sort of real recurrence of injuries and that kind of thing. I've never been one to suffer like muscle injuries and that. All of my injuries have always been something happening that stops me in my tracks. Not a case of, oh, I just don't fancy it today, or I just... It's always been, there you go, your leg's broken, so deal with that. Or there you go, your cartilage in the knee, deal with that. You've dislocated your shoulder, deal with that. And that's the side, that's the level of honesty that you have to come to terms with. And things that you have to deal with. I've spent a lot of months in the gym. I've spent a lot of times where I was young and I thought I didn't have to do so much in the gym. You only learn that. I wish, obviously, hindsight's a wonderful thing. I wish I knew now. I wish I knew then what I know now. But I suppose everybody does.
Into the last 10 minutes of the podcast, you talked a lot about low points in your career. Mm. What have been the high points?
Just getting up every day and playing football. You know, I class that as an amazing thing. And that's wherever I've been. You know, good days, bad days. The fact that you get up in the morning and you kick a football and you feel, you know, as a side effect of playing football is being fit and healthy. Getting well paid for it. Just, you know, being able to enjoy, you know, your family on the outside of it, and, you know, do things with your family that your sort of background suggests you can't do.
Because you've earned enough money to take the type of holidays, yeah, that lads in a working class background like you, where you're from, wouldn't, yeah, have been able to take.
Exactly, that kind of thing. So
you made it.
I wouldn't say made it, because made it to me would have been...
You played in the Premier League.
But made it in my head is making it, and Giggsy made it, Scholesy made it. You know, Coley made it. They won trophies. You know, that kind of thing is made it. I don't have a piece of silverware. I've got a runners-up medal from an FA Cup final with Portsmouth. But, you know, that's to me is what you grow up as a kid, you made it.
What was Portsmouth like in that era? I can remember going there and standing in the away end, I think it was 2007, mm-hmm, first away game of the season, it was a, yeah, night match, proper pain to get to Portsmouth and back. Yeah. And I remember thinking, they're paying more than Tottenham Hotspur now, this, yeah, is a bit ridiculous, this.
Yeah, it was a funny time to join the club, because I just left Sheffield United in the Championship and obviously went to Portsmouth in the Prem. And I was on a free transfer. We came in, and you know, you're looking around the dressing room, and you're thinking, got John, you know, John Yutaka, Kanu, Yunus Kabul, David James, you know, the squad that is more than capable of doing all sorts, you know. But it was just up and down, and the downs were more, you know, obviously getting into financial trouble and relegation. And I mean, my first month at the club, I remember thinking, oh, okay, great, you know. Signed, as far as I'm concerned, a decent enough contract. I get on with football now, you know, work hard, get in the team, that kind of thing. And then a few days later, or, you know, a couple of weeks later, there's a meeting being called. Oh, sorry, lad, you're not going to get your wages. Tanya Robinson, who was the finance director at the time, she came in and was so nervous to have to present to the lads. You know, she actually had to sit down with a glass of water. She didn't know what to say, and she's got, you know, numerous seasoned professionals quizzing her about, you know, what's going on, what is going on, because at the end of the day, everybody has their commitments to, you know, outside of football, and people say, oh well, he's been playing for 15 years and he's an X, Y, Z. However, it doesn't matter. You, everybody goes to work to, you know, you, it's an agreement by with both people, basically.
It's a contract. Any contract. A contract.
It's a contract, yeah. So, and everyone went, okay, yeah, fine, no problem. It'll be a couple of days. No one's bothered. But a couple of days turned into 5 days. 5 days turned into 10 days. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, what's that really happened? Going on here? And then you'd get paid, and then it's almost like, okay, it's gone. The next payday would come, and it would be like, okay, could be, you're building up to it. What's going on here? What's really going on? Whereas you're hearing nothing out of this. It was just, you know, it's, oh, sorry, we just had a little bit of a, you know, a structuring of finance problem and that kind of thing.
But you see straight through. Just dabbing it.
Yeah. So, you know, when it would get later and later, and then bonuses wouldn't get paid, but, oh, they would get them in the middle of the month and you don't get them and all that kind of thing. And, you know, it upset, especially people who've come from, say, foreign lads who've come from wherever they've come from. They expect to be paid. You know, it's a little bit, and, you know, quite rightly so. You know, nobody, rarely do people go to work for free. Everybody has families, commitments. You know, you don't move to another country just to go and be a volunteer, you know, on a regular basis. If you have family, if you have a family, you've got kids, you've got, some people have come from absolutely nothing, like absolutely, you know, some of the African lads and stuff like that, they, you know, so it wasn't, it was a time where, you know, it was suggested at one point where we went out, I remember, it had gone on for quite a few months. I remember we played City and we were live on a Sunday against City, and it was quite thought of at the time that we just, when they kick off, we just stand there, and, you know, it was, we just stand there and do nothing. And, you know, live Sky game, it would make a stance, just look, you know, this can't happen with the amount of money that's being put into football. This can't happen, that, you know, fans' money gets put else, you know, wherever the finance people choose to take it and taking out the club and that kind of thing. You know, the bottom line is it's about the game of football. We sat there and we talked, you know, people were talking and the coach saying, well, what, you know, what would happen if we did that? If we just went, okay, kick off, live Sky, 4 o'clock kick off. What you gonna, you know, what?
I think you should have done it.
Thing is, the problem is, it's, again, it's the ratio of who would have done it and who wouldn't have done it. You know what I mean?
Straight away.
Because it's,
you can't, yeah.
But what, you know, and the, a lot of people, so, you know, you're protecting your other people's opinion of you. So you think, well, if I do that, well, you know, the people think, oh, why is he doing that? He's being paid money, and dad, he's earned money. And so there's a lot of factors to weigh up. Also, you know,
what about the fans who've travelled to see?
Exactly, yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, we should have known. We got beat.
Last couple of minutes. Sheffield United had a song of Greasy Chip Butty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There isn't a better one in football, I don't think.
No, it's good. It's. I remember when I first went there, the only thing you'd hear, you wouldn't know the rest of the song, you just hear, oh, Greasy Chip Butty. What's that all about? And then obviously as time goes on, you end up finding out, but it's, yeah, it's classic. It's original, isn't it? It's class.
You played for Leeds United. I'm going to give you 7 seconds to describe your Leeds career.
Leeds, big club, should be in a Premiership, right, because we had great games against United. You know, they had great games against United along the years. However, it was short and sweet.
Mm-hmm. You're at Accrington now, you're 31. What does the future hold for you? Is it in football? How long would you like to keep on playing?
I'll play, you know, I didn't play last season at all.
Why?
One, because I'd had a slight operation on my knee, and just gave me, I took thinking time out of football, which most people don't do, and I thought to myself, right, I'm 30, where do I go with my life? You know, I won't be 35 and just act like it's a shock to me that I've just finished football. You know, that can't happen. So I've, you know, I've had other ventures outside of football, that kind of thing, which kept me busy and made me sort of think, do I love football the way I used to love it? The answer is yes, I do. Do I love playing football, the type of football that I don't enjoy? It's a different answer. You know, it's a different question with a different answer. However, I do enjoy the camaraderie. I know every time I step onto a football pitch, I'll always give my best. That's a given. I know that about myself, and I've known that about myself for a while. So where do I go with football? I just play, I train every day, I play as hard as I can, and I do it because I enjoy it, and I'll get the best out of myself for the remaining years of my career, enjoying what I do, and that's the main factor.
And you've never had to wake up on a golf course?
Never, no, it was not me.
You've survived so far?
So far, mate, yeah. It's I'll leave that to other people. Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it, thank you.
So that's it for this podcast. A couple of days after I met Danny, United were beaten by West Bromwich Albion, which was not good. The new United We Stand is now out. You may have seen the Eric Steele interview, which made the mainstream media. Doesn't really reflect the tone of what Eric said. He was very positive about Manchester United, about David De Gea, and very insightful as well. Spoke to him for 2 hours, nearly 6,000 words, so there's loads there, and the only place you can find that is in United We Stand for the full interview. You can order that from the uwsonline.com website, and will be on sale for the next couple of games outside Old Trafford. Cheers to everyone who bought it before the West Brom game. Hope that was a high point of a bad day for you. We're going to start working on the next mag soon, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.